Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about Whooping Cough, Last Best Outdoors Fest, and the Northern Cheyenne Nation's new solar farm. It's Friday, September 6th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. Between 1901 and 1922, 17 libraries from Missoula to Miles City and Havre to Dillon were built in Montana. As Kay Erickson reports, there's a new book that takes us back to the turn of the 20th century, when the generosity of a Scottish immigrant and the vision of 17 Montana communities brought libraries to the far reaches of the state.
The seed money for these libraries in Montana and elsewhere across the U.S. came from one of the richest men of the late 19th and 20th centuries, Andrew Carnegie, who said that a, quote, library outranks any one thing a community can do to benefit its people, unquote.
His is the original Horatio Alger story.
That's Kate Hampton, the author of a new book, The Best Gift, Montana's Carnegie Libraries, which shares how these libraries came to be. Carnegie was barely a teen when his family emigrated from Scotland, working his way up from a bobbin boy in a cotton factory to one of the richest men in America. Hampton says Carnegie credited his success and thirst for knowledge to having access to a library, and he thought the one way to give back, an obligation he took seriously, was to fund libraries.
He thought that public libraries then would be the best gift to give to a community so that it could help people help themselves and improve their lot in life.
Carnegie provided grants to build, but the communities also had to pledge financial support.
Part of the deal was if Carnegie promised you $10,000, let's say, to build a library, then your community had to promise to pay $1,000, so 10% of that cost, every year to maintain the library into the future.
And they needed to secure the land for the library.
And that was often one of the items on the checklist that slowed down progress in getting the funding and getting the building built, is that agreement of where these places should stand and acquiring those properties in town.
Library director Jackie Scott says there were some disagreements over where to build the Big Timber Library.
The Women's Club originally bought the lot American Legion stands on. So that is on 3rd Avenue. And the people in charge, the council, the other groups, they wanted the building to be on McLeod on the main street. There was some back and forth about that. Then they sold that piece of land, purchased this piece of land on McLeod. And then they weren't sure if they wanted it to face McLeod or face 4th Avenue.
And the women's groups in these communities, like the one in Big Timber, that author Kate Hampton credits with getting these libraries constructed.
The women's clubs rallied together. They often collected names on petitions. They encouraged their city or county commissioners to instigate that correspondence between the community and the Carnegie Corporation in order to secure those funds. The women's groups really were kind of the heart and soul of the library communities.
And the women's groups were there after construction, when Montana was in the grips of a depression and support from property taxes went down.
Keeping those libraries alive and vibrant and centers for information and community really did fall to those women's groups who volunteered as librarians, who did fundraisers and kept them going throughout the 20th century.
The first 8 of these libraries in Montana, completed between 1902 and 1907, reflect a freedom of style with domes, stone columns, and local materials and some grandly scaled entries and windows. By 1909, design was more restrained with brick veneer exteriors and rectangular footprints, what became known as the Carnegie Classic Design. Of the 17 Carnegie libraries in Montana, 6 no longer house libraries, but are home to things like an art gallery, museum, and law office. 2 no longer exist, Glasgow and Great Falls demolished their buildings in 1965. 9 are still libraries, like in Big Timber, and still a vibrant part of the community. Big Timber's library director, Jackie Scott.
It has been so important to this city and county that when it was no longer big enough, they raised $1.2 million to put on a renovation and expansion.
This Saturday afternoon, the Big Timber Carnegie Library will host the launch of Kate Hampton's Libraries book, and visitors will also get the first look at an exhibit that will travel across the state, sharing Andrew Carnegie's impact in these 17 communities.
What a lasting legacy.
With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Kay Erickson.
Montana now has 12 times as many confirmed pertussis cases than this time last year. That's according to the latest State Health Department report showing there are more than 440 reported pertussis or whooping cough cases in Montana. That compares to 37 cases at this time last year. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien has more.
Missoula County is seeing the vast majority of Montana's pertussis cases. As of Thursday, there were 169 confirmed reports.
So this is an unprecedented number of cases.
Cindy Farr, Health Promotion Director at the Missoula City County Health Department, says that until now,
the highest number of cases that we've seen in one outbreak occurred several years ago, back in 2012, and we had 23 cases.
Farr says that could explain this recent surge. No one really saw it coming.
Pertussis wasn't what providers were thinking at all. And so we had some of our earlier cases that were coughing for weeks and weeks and weeks. I think that it just really got root in our community before it was recognized. Now we're having a much more difficult time getting rid of it.
Missoula cases are getting reported from across the age spectrum in both the vaccinated and unvaccinated. Whooping cough reports slowed this summer but did not go away altogether. Confirmed cases continued to roll in an average of 2 per week. That has health officials on guard here at the start of the school year.
It's really important that everyone knows how to properly wash their hands, cover their cough, stay home if they're sick, keep their kids home if they're sick. And if they seem like they're having symptoms that, which I know sound a lot like a cold, runny nose, sneezing, mild to severe cough, then they should probably get checked out by a healthcare provider just to make sure that it's not pertussis.
People who have been vaccinated generally have less severe symptoms, but they can still spread the disease. According to the State Health Department, 22 counties have reported at least one pertussis case this year. The latest report from late last month shows Flathead County with 82 cases and 66 in Gallatin County. Yellowstone County has at least 10 confirmed cases. Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
A federally funded group of substance abuse counselors, service providers, and law enforcement in Yellowstone County met this week to work on a coordinated plan to tackle drug abuse in Billings and the surrounding area. Kayla DeRoche reports.
The Yellowstone Substance Abuse Connect Coalition released a comprehensive assessment of drug abuse in Yellowstone County in July. The assessment confirmed that methamphetamine and meth-related violent crime is an issue. Helena-based consultant Katie Loveland said there are a lot of different agencies trying to tackle the same group of problems, and the next step is carving out a plan to tackle them in an organized way.
And it's fascinating to see where there's strong things and then where there's real opportunities to improve. And some of it is just the sustained partnerships where people are actually working together on an ongoing basis. So
Loveland was at a 50-person Yellowstone Connect meeting in Billings Wednesday and Thursday to help guide that discussion. Among those present was Marcy Neary. She's the director of the Community Crisis Center, which provides counseling, referrals, and social services to people struggling with mental health issues and substance abuse. Over a lunch of wraps and tortilla chips, Neary said many of the most in-need people don't have the insurance to cover available services. And without that insurance, they join a long wait list for programs they do qualify for.
They give up hope, and they go out and use. They come back in our door maybe months later. They start the process over again. They get on the waiting list. Sometimes their name comes up, and because we're a crisis center, we don't follow them around, or they don't have access to phones. And so they get lost in the system.
She says her biggest concern is a lack of resources for those who need immediate help. She has hope that Yellowstone Connect can form a system that provides a way forward for them. Yellowstone Connect has commissioned a plan based on input from meetings like the one this week in Billings. It should be released by the end of the year. Kayla DeRoche, YPR News.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced the release of the first comprehensive conservation plan for the National Bison Range on the Flathead Indian Reservation yesterday. As Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports, the plan comes after 2 years of public comments.
The Comprehensive Conservation Plan for the National Bison Range is now in its final stages. On Friday, the plan will be announced in the Federal Register, opening the last comment period for the document. Manager Amy Kaufman says the CCP doesn't change a whole lot, but it does combine several management plans, touching everything from herd size to force on the range.
This is more of a general plan which covers all of those plans at a larger scale.
Some changes the CCP will bring is more collaboration with local, tribal, and state partners when the Bison Range releases surplus animals to other conservation herds around the country and other management practices.
There's going to be more cooperative efforts as we go down that road. Prescribed fire management will definitely continue to work with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes.
This follows a long debate about whether the Salish and Kootenai tribes should manage the range, which falls within the borders of the Flathead Reservation. The Fish and Wildlife Service declined to transfer management in 2017 due to, quote, a variety of information and perspectives. The Salish and Kootenai tribes were unable to comment by deadline Thursday. The CCP does not address a potential transfer, but in an emailed statement, Fish and Wildlife said, quote, the selected alternative in the final CCP/EIS for NBR could serve as the basis for negotiation about a potential future annual funding agreement. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio.
On the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, Busby has water again after losing it Tuesday afternoon. As Olivia Reingold reports, the two-day shortage affected school openings.
When Principal Melvin Mitchell found out that the Northern Cheyenne Tribal School would have to send kids home early on Tuesday because of low water pressure, he wasn't surprised.
It happens on and off periodically, and you know, it's something that we've dealt with off and on since I've been there for the past 2 years.
He says the school has to shut down 12 to 15 days a year because of problems with water and other maintenance issues. A source at the Northern Cheyenne Utility Commission, which oversees Busby's water supply, says the problem was two defunct pumps. The source says the 10-year-old pumps were both replaced for $10,000. Principal Mitchell again.
It is very frustrating in terms of, you know, students missing instructional days and not taking advantage of that core instruction that they need to improve our assessment scores.
In the most recent accreditation report from Montana's Office of Public Instruction, the elementary, middle, and high school branches of the Northern Cheyenne Tribal School are marked as deficiency status, primarily because of student performance. But Mitchell says there's only so much he can do, especially when the school already has an average of up to 15 snow days a year. Thursday evening, he'll meet with the elementary school principal and school superintendent to discuss reopening school Friday. They're free to do so, as the Utility Commission says water has been back up and running in Busby since 5 p.m. Wednesday. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
Groups promoting the economic value of public lands in Montana held their third annual event to get their message out in Missoula Wednesday. Montana Public Radio's Eric Whitney dropped in on part of the last Best Outdoors Fest.
The event brought bands, beer, and information booths to Karras Park downtown and a panel of business leaders to speak at the Wilma Theater.
We aren't just a place that you can come visit, but we're a place that you can come make a living.
Evan Tipton was on the panel. He's the founder and CEO of Thomas, a Missoula-based digital marketing agency for tour operators. Tipton said the value of Montana's outdoor amenities goes beyond attracting tourists. It makes it possible for companies here to attract top talent away from bigger markets like Silicon Valley, which he competes with for employees. Tipton says there's great ROI, return on investment, on having an environment where businesses can attract talented people and grow.
50% of our employees are UM graduates, so it really is bringing new talent in. And there's a very strong ROI on someone that makes a software developer's salary in terms of the houses that they buy, the increases the taxable base, but then retaining our talent. keeping our kids here can be hard to do.
This recognition that Montana's outdoors has economic value beyond attracting tourists is something that's only lately becoming widely acknowledged in the state, says Marnie Haynes with the group Business for Montana's Outdoors. That group formed 7 years ago to highlight the value of the state's natural resources beyond traditional extractive industries like logging and mining.
I do think that we don't talk enough about the industries, the peripheral industries that are benefiting from the outdoors, the people that are saying, I could be anywhere. I could be in a major city. I could be, you know, fill in the blank. And I'm here in Montana because the outdoor way of life is, and the quality of the outdoor way of life is so important to what happens in my work culture and what my employees enjoy and what drives innovation, that's why I'm here. I don't think it's a new message. I think it's a message that we just need to keep reiterating because the periphery is what we don't talk about enough.
And what Hayes calls the periphery of outdoor-related jobs helps drive businesses that more obviously benefit from Montana's natural amenities. Todd Frank runs the Trailhead Outdoor Clothing and Equipment Shops in Missoula.
A group of physicians brought in a doctor who they were trying to recruit to Missoula. They introduced me and they said, this is John. He's going to be a new physician with us, and you need to hook him up with everything he needs to be happy in Missoula, which means a boat and backcountry skis, and on goes the list. And so I look at it not necessarily as a tourism thing as much as it is really growing our whole economy based on the assets that we have in our public land. And so for me, it's incredibly important.
Last Best Outdoors Fest was sponsored by Business for Montana's Outdoors, the Montana Wilderness Association, the Montana Wildlife Federation, and the Wilderness Society. I'm Eric Whitney, Montana Public Radio.
The Northern Cheyenne Nation received a $2 million federal grant this summer to build a new solar farm. As Olivia Reingold reports, it's part of the tribe's decision to invest in renewable energy over mining their rich coal deposits.
The first thing Kyle Alderman got when he started his job was a tower of grant paperwork. Then he learned the tribe was awarded a matching grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to start the White River Community Solar Project.
Speechless. You know, it's not the biggest solar farm in America, but it is the biggest that we have on the res.
A month earlier, Alderman had been learning about renewable energy as a student at MSU Bozeman. Now, he's the tribe's first renewable energy manager.
How many people are in this department now?
There's just me.
But soon he'll be bringing 25 to 30 construction workers on board, who he hopes to pay at least $15 an hour. But he says the impact will go beyond job creation. That's because the solar farm is also intended to lower electricity bills on the reservation, which Alderman says can skyrocket in winter because that's how most families get their heat, including his.
Over the winter, one bill was $600. And, you know, that's hard on families. That money's not easy to come by.
But some people are paying more than three times what he is. That's according to a community survey he conducted. Respondents said they pay anywhere from $200 to $2,000 in the summer and from $375 to more than $3,000 in the winter. The White River Project is expected to save the tribe about $5 million a year. It'll generate 2.6 megawatts of power, or enough to power over 400 homes and three tribal buildings. It's still dwarfed by the Colstrip Power Plant, which is a coal-powered plant about 45 minutes north.
This solar farm is roughly 1/1000th of the energy generated by Colstrip.
But he says that makes sense because Colstrip provides power to people up and down the West Coast, whereas the Northern Cheyenne Solar Farm will be for homes and buildings in Busbee and structures throughout the reservation.
Nice to meet you, Olivia. Thank you so much. Okay, bye.
It'll be built in Busbee, where today it's sunny and 92 degrees. As a cloudless, bright day, it's the perfect conditions for solar energy.
Don't play with matches.
That's Republican State Senator Jason Small joking with his kids, who aren't anywhere near matches. They're in water shoes and bathing suits, ready for an afternoon at a Northern Cheyenne swimming hole. But first, they stop to get some cold drinks at a Busbee convenience store.
Grab me a Pepsi, too. Or sweet tea. Get whatever you guys want.
George Hodges, the convenience store owner, tells Small he'll have to pay with exact change because the power is out.
Do the outages happen a lot?
Yeah, we have a lot of outages. There was one just last week.
Some people on the reservation say their electricity is too unreliable and expensive, but State Senator Small doesn't know if the solar farm will solve that.
The ability for it to actually help somebody here really is banking on the fact that hopefully the tribe makes a good deal.
He's talking about the deal that the Northern Cheyenne will have to strike with the utility to put the solar farm's power back onto the grid. That's because utilities like the Tongue River Electric Cooperative and the Bighorn County Electric Cooperative own the lines. He says the tribe could make money if they negotiate a net metering deal with the utilities. That means that the utilities would pay the tribe for any extra energy they put on the grid but don't use. A few years ago, Small was all in on coal. Listen to this line from a 2015 op-ed he wrote, quote, "Developing the tribe's natural resources to full potential may become paramount to succeeding as a sovereign nation." But now he's not so sure.
I'm about as pro-coal as you can get, but I'm also wise enough to understand the fact that there's a lull right now, and there's, you know, we're just not going to make the progress with it that I personally would hope to make.
You don't have to go far to see that the coal industry is struggling. Colstrip Power Plant is scheduled to shut down two of its four units this year, Westmoreland Coal Company and Black Jewel LLC, two of the leading coal mining companies in the country, filed for bankruptcy this year. At one point, about 600 people in Wyoming lost their jobs. Senator Small hopes that coal will rebound, but to other Northern Cheyenne tribal members, what the market does is irrelevant. Some say it goes against the tribe's cultural and spiritual values to mine coal, no matter how tempting the payoff may be.
Hey, come in.
Hi.
There you are, man.
Yes, hello.
Holy.
Philip Whiteman Jr. and his wife, Lynette Tubles, run a nonprofit, Yellowbird, that helps inspire Northern Cheyenne children to reconnect with the land and their cultural roots. Whiteman runs and grabs a binder full of photocopies and photos of traditional texts.
Okie dokie.
He pulls out a paper with a teaching from Sweet Medicine, a Cheyenne prophet who lived with the tribe for four generations, and begins reading.
Okay.
It says strangers called Earthmen will appear among the tribe and try to introduce an industrial culture.
Follow nothing that these Earthmen do, but keep your own ways that I have taught you as long as you can.
Whiteman says Sweet Medicine warned the Cheyenne to not follow the Earthman because his industrial culture pollutes the land. Next door, the Crow Nation just gave out per capita payments last month. Enrolled members are getting a $230 payment, which comes from coal mined on Crow land. Whiteman's wife, Tubles, says she knows the Northern Cheyenne could have a slice of that pie if they wanted, but...
You know, there's a lot of other peoples that choose, you know, the money over the land, the natural resources. And really, that's up to them. But I think because of the strong connection, you see that continued, you know, fight against the coal and looking for other alternatives.
Tubal says she hopes this is just the beginning. She wants to see more renewable energy on Northern Cheyenne land. First, Alderman, the tribe's renewable energy manager, will have to negotiate with the utility companies. He says the next step is developing a feasibility study to see how the grid will handle the power of the solar farm. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.